us bless our youth and send them on their merry way. A little bit more merry, children. Merry. Merry. There we go. All righty. Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Church of the Messiah. Tonight we will be covering chapters 4 and 5 of 50 Days of Glory. Anyway, today we're covering... Hey, Liz. Greg just walked us... Okay, cool. Never mind. That'll be really interesting on the recording. Today we'll be covering the time that Jesus appeared to the disciples in the upper room without Thomas. Thomas is next week. So, we're going to start with chapter 4. Behind a locked door. And our verses are Luke 24, 33 through 43, and John 20, 19 through 25, which are coincidentally the same verses for next chapter. But let's not get confused. All right, so, I've got to highlight some just special parts in this chapter and in the next chapter, and we're just going to try and be selective about what we talk about. Try and keep us here for less than 2 hours. So, Canon Pearson picks up here where, almost exactly where he left off in the last chapter, literally with Cleopas and his buddy realizing that it's Jesus. Jesus disappears, and they go, wow, this is incredible, and they literally pack up and they run off, which is incredible because it means they've run off at night. They've run off at night and run the 7 miles back to Jerusalem, the 60 stadia. They get back to Jerusalem. They go back, and they find the disciples. They find them in the upper room, and they say, you're not going to believe what just happened. We just had this encounter with Jesus. He's alive. He's back from the dead. But what's shocking to me, and what I've never really noticed before, is that when they get back there, before they can even say, we just saw Jesus and we had this conversation with him, he told us all about this, and he was known to us in the breaking of bread, before they tell their story, the apostles say, Jesus is alive, and he appeared to Peter. Now the really remarkable thing is, this is documented in Luke, and it's documented in Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 5, part A, very first part of chapter 5, okay? It's documented there, but it's not recorded anywhere else. Luke says that when they got there, they said, he appeared to Peter. And St. Paul says in his list of resurrection appearances, don't you know that once he came back from the dead, he appeared to Simon and all these other list of people. But it never, and then Cleopas says, all this happened to us. And they're still amazed. They're still wondering. But it never says anywhere in the Gospels, or says anywhere else, what happened in that encounter. That's a passage I'd like to know about. But it's not included. That's one of those left out elements that'd be really interesting to hear about. There's a brief section where Canon Pearson talks about the fact that these guys are referred to as the 11. I know there's technically only 10, but this is not a problem, okay, because the 11 is a title referring to the group, okay? And it's that group is referred to as such, even if it's not technically those people. Canon Pearson refers to his home team as the 9, even though there's how many people are on a Major League Baseball team now? Like 37 or something? Who knows? I don't watch baseball. It's about 30 minutes worth of action crammed into about 3.5 hours. But, you know, the example that I think of is the Three Musketeers. The Three Musketeers, typically when you're talking about Three Musketeers, you're actually talking about how many people? Four. You're actually talking about Athos, Porthos, Aramis, and D'Artagnan. And when you're talking about those four people, they talk about the Three Musketeers. Anyway, so it's not really about a number, it's about the group. So the fact that one of them wasn't there doesn't mean that somebody made a mistake. It means that, you know, it's the 11. Okay, so Thomas wasn't there. He was buying groceries or something. Who knows what he was doing? It's probably something dubious. Anyway, all right, so one of the first main points that he makes is that it was in the biblical times that we made it in the apostolic era that we transitioned from worshiping on the Sabbath on Saturday to worshiping on Sunday. Okay, it was very early on, and he quotes this guy who's an apostolic father. He says at the end of the first century, with John the Apostle still alive, Ignatius of Antioch wrote to the Magnesian Christians that Christians are no longer living for the Saturday, Sabbath, but for the Lord's Day, on which life dawned for us through him and his death. Magnesians 9:1. Ignatius of Antioch he's this really interesting figure. The first generation of Christian writers following the death of almost all of the apostles, actually John was still alive when some of them were writing, were known as the apostolic fathers. They were the guys who were appointed to their positions by the apostles. They were the ones who, when Jesus appointed the apostles and said, go out, and the apostles went out, when the apostles were getting near the ends of their times, they said, you know what, I want you to take over the church now. Those guys, when they wrote epistles and letters, they were referred to as the apostolic fathers. There's about 6 or 7 of them. Three of the most significant are a guy named Polycarp of Smyrna, Clement of Rome, and Ignatius of Antioch. Okay, Ignatius of Antioch was put in his position by St. John, and he was trained by St. John, and it's his letters are just a real tremendous wealth of information about what the earliest churches were like. And so he talks about this, and you can see that from the very first era of the church, this is what they're doing. They're worshiping not on Saturday, as the Jews did, but on Sunday. And here's why. Because of this is why. They worshiped like that because, hey, this is when the Lord brought life to us. On the next slide it says, Christ inaugurated the new covenant and with it new observances. Sunday is indeed the Lord's day, and on this day he rose from the dead. While it is the first day of the week, it is also the eighth day, the eschatological day. Eschatological means end. The eschaton is the end. The question is, what does eschatological mean? The eschaton is the end. So a lot of people confuse eschatological with apocalyptic. A lot of people think that when you're talking about eschatology, you're thinking about, or when you're talking about apocalyptic literature, you're thinking about the end of days. Well, apocalyptic literature is literature that reveals something. It's not necessarily the end of the world or the end of days or something like that, but they're often grouped together. Okay, eschatological material, eschatological literature, eschatological anything, is that which has to do with the end. Okay, so when it says, while it is the first day of the week, it is also the eighth day, the eschatological day, the end day, the day of the new covenant. Just as creation began on day one, God's new creation begins on the second day one, which is Sunday. Okay, so we begin on day one, we begin anew on day one. Okay, so on the first day, God speaks, let there be light, creation begins. On Sunday, which is day one of the new covenant, Jesus comes back from the dead and we have a new covenant. We have new, as he says here, new observances. And we begin a new way of worship, or a new day of worship at the very least. So this is the last days. This is how we worship as we are drawing to the close. It's a very good question. Apocalyptic literature, the apocalypse literally means the unveiling. The same word is used in a wedding ceremony when the groom lifts off the veil from the bride. It is an apocalypse. It is an unveiling. So when the angels in Revelation and Daniel and Zechariah start explaining things to the different prophets there, even John in the book of Revelation, which in Greek is called the Apocalypse, that is a moment of revelation. That is a moment of apocalypse. It is an unveiling because the angel at that point says, this is what it means. Okay? Okay. At one point he says something that's really interesting. He says, you know, the disciples, we have to give them some credit. The apostles, the disciples, we got to give them some credit because Holy Week had not ended well for any of them except for John. Okay? At Gethsemane, they had all turned tail and run. They had headed off for the hills. They had left Jesus. Peter had betrayed him, denied him three times. Only John had stuck by him, and even he didn't stick by him the whole time. He just sort of got back there at the end. Okay? Everybody else had not had a good ending of Holy Week. So they all had some things to sort of have their heads down about when they were in the upper room, but they were all still together. They were still meeting together. They were still gathering together. They hadn't split up. And then Canon Pearson says, we may not understand everything the Christian faith teaches, and we certainly know how far short we fall from godly discipleship. But if we are actively in the game, through prayer, Bible study, corporate worship, receiving Holy Communion, and active fellowship with other believers, we give God room to move in us, through us, and for us. This is one of those, I think he says something like, showing up is 80% of success. Yeah, I don't like that guy, so. He's pretty much, yeah, there you go. But a much better example is when he talks about, the boat. You know, you can't put the wind in the sails, but you can make sure that you've raised the sails and put out to sea. Okay, you've got to make sure that you've raised the sails and lifted the anchor, where it won't matter whether or not there's wind. You've got to do your part. Okay? And then he asks a really interesting question that he gives about five answers to, and some of the answers are really good. Why were the apostles still disbelieving and wondering? Luke 24:41 says they still didn't believe. So how could that be? Because now you're talking about at least five witnesses, maybe more. At least Mary Magdalene had seen Jesus. Peter had seen Jesus. Cleopas and his companion had seen Jesus. So you have at least those four people who had seen Jesus. Okay? Maybe another woman. We don't know. Plus there had been the angels. All right, there's plenty of people who said they see Jesus. Why are they still not believing? How could this be? What's wrong with these folks? Okay. Number one, it's too good to be true. Okay, this is the pinch me, must be dreaming mentality. Okay? Somebody comes up and they tell you something, and you're just like, yeah, that's too good to be true. I'm sure we can all relate. About number two. Just because I believe God works miracles doesn't necessarily mean I believe he's working miracles now. Or, in particular, just because I believe he works miracles doesn't mean I believe he's working miracles for me. Yes, clearly, God heals small little Haitian children in islands riddled by earthquakes, but that doesn't mean he's going to heal me of my headache or my backache or whatever. Okay? Yeah, I believe he does these things, but I don't know that he's going to do it for me. Or maybe even I believe he'll do it for you, but I don't think he'll do it for me. Maybe I've got some sort of self-esteem issue or some issue with God, and I think that I've got some issue that's holding me back from receiving that. Maybe I'm some rotten, miserable sinner, and you're obviously not. Okay? Number three. We can sort of believe. This is that sort of hazy area between real doubt and real belief. Maybe we're praying for a healing and what we're really asking for is the medicine to work more effectively or the doctors to finally figure out what in the heck they're doing. But we're not really praying for me to walk out of this room being absolutely fine. Right? Maybe the apostles were expecting like a vision of Jesus or a warm fuzzy feeling or, you know, that little, yeah, peaceful easy feeling, something like that. I don't know. Maybe they were expecting some sort of metaphorical thing, some sort of vision of Jesus. They were expecting something other than Jesus to walk in and like high five them. How you doing, guys? They weren't expecting a fully risen bodily Jesus to walk through the door. Get it? Walk through the door. It was locked. Anyway, tough crowd. Number four. Yeah. Number four. Christians can be very double-minded. It's not unusual, says Canon Pearson, for Christians in one breath to testify to the incredible blessings the Lord has recently performed in our lives, while in the next breath to speak of fears we have that some other difficulty we are facing will turn out badly. Well, and that's a little unfair because, truth be told, that's kind of pervasive throughout Scripture. Frankly, the best example of this is Elijah. Elijah, this guy is practically bipolar, okay? In 1 Kings 18, you have this incredibly epic battle where you've got the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, where they're hooting and hollering and pouring oil over their altars and poking themselves and calling blood all over themselves and calling down their God. And if you look at the translation, he's taunting them. He basically says, is your God on the toilet? Is that why he's not responding? Is he in the loo? Is that why he hasn't come over here and lit your altar on fire? So he pours water over his altar. God still sends fire down and consumes both it and their altar. He then goes and slaughters all of them and basically says, what now? Takes out everybody. Says basically, by the way, his name, the L-I basically means my God, and Yah is Yahweh. Basically, his name means my God is Yahweh. My God is the Lord. Right? His name is my God is the Lord. And he basically stands up there and says, "What now?" And the very next chapter, he hears that Jezebel is out to kill him, and he runs hiding into a cave and is scared to death for his life. What? What? This is the guy who somebody came up to him and said, "The king wants to see you now. Come with us or else." And he called down fire from heaven and smote the entire battalion. Three times. The fourth time, the guy comes up to him and says, "We would very much like it if you would walk with us and come have a conversation with the king." "Okay, let's go for a walk." Okay. And still, the queen's going to kill me? My God, what am I going to do? Anyway, so, yeah, we shouldn't feel bad. We should know in our hearts and in our heads that, look, this is the way things are. But until you've, like, done these miracles like Elijah has, and then have felt like, you know, you're still going to be overwhelmed and drowned and all that kind of stuff, then, you know, then we'll consider it a little differently. All right, and finally, the fifth reason.